Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, bad news. Lots and lots of bad news. And I guess some good news. There's some good news. Well, there's good news about bad news. All right, well, I said it before, and I wasn't intentionally lying, but I'll say it again. Said it before, and I'll say it again. The website's supposedly going to be fixed today. Well, you know, there were problems with it breaking and problems with getting it fixed. The good thing about me is I don't know how to do any of that stuff. It's not here. It's someone else's responsibility, so it's somebody else's fault, not mine. I'm a victim just like you. You know, he warned me. He said, you know, you should do a Kickstarter for new servers before you do a Kickstarter for the YouTube thing. And I said, well, you know, we already got this thing going on, and so. Yeah. Well, I guess once we get the website up on the temporary server up and going, I can write a blog entry about it and things like that. That's what I'm going to do. How bad my overall listenership will have suffered from this? I don't know. Site's been down for a week and 3 days now, so that's pretty good. But anyway, the show's still on. Here I am right now. Yeah, that's scotthorton.org. There's a splash page there. At least it's not given just a 404 error or whatever the hell. So it's coming back. Also, you can find me at liberty.me. liberty.me/members/Scott Horton Show. That's where I live there. You can find me on liberty.me. Sign up, why don't you? It's cheap, and there's no ads. All right. Yeah. And then, so I don't know, man. I got a bunch of invites out, but they don't seem to be working. I invite people. They ignore me. I don't know. Maybe they're sick of me. That makes sense. Seems like maybe I should have quit years ago. But anyway. All right. So, yeah, one of the people I was trying to get on the show is Daniel Larrison, because he's been writing some really great stuff lately at the American Conservative Magazine. And he's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. U.S. backing for the disastrous war on Yemen continues. A good one. Actually, Justin's got a good one along those lines today at antiwar.com as well. Check that out. But I got a ton of news stories to cover. And I guess I'll start with the arrested Somalis, because I don't know that much about it, so I won't have that much to say about it. Other than, for one example, according to ABC News, 6 Minnesota men charged with allegedly trying to help ISIS. And yet, as you could have guessed, this was a months-long sting operation by the FBI. So, they are guilty until proven innocent, the cops. You can, absolutely, you can bet dollars to dimes. Is it dimes to dollars? I don't know which is the best way to say it. But anyway, yeah, it's dollars to dimes. You could bet that the cops put these guys up to it. And maybe they were, you know, saying this and that. And the cops decided to make it a federal case. And so they did. But then again, on the other hand, I've kind of been predicting this thing for a long time, and it seems like it's pretty easy to assume. Never even mind. Well, even with the informant, even with the FBI going undercover, maybe these guys really were going to do something before the cops went undercover. Let's just pretend for a minute. Maybe that's why the cops went undercover, that these guys were seriously going to do something. It seems a miracle to me that they're saying that the plot was, maybe this is why you know it was a sting, the plot was to go to Syria to fight for ISIS there. When it seems like any idiot, if you wanted to join the jihad, could just stay here and fight the jihad here. Not that I'm recommending that, you stupids. I'm not an FBI informant. Anyone who's recommending that to you, probably an FBI informant. Think about that. Just see, there's only, 65, 70 examples now, something like that. Anyway, the point is, it makes sense when you have a gigantic Somali population living in Minnesota that kind of all came here at once, over a short period of time, and they got people back home, and America has destroyed their country back, where they're from. In Pakistan, that kind of happens, but I think most Pakistani Americans, their relatives aren't living in the Swat Valley, They're from elsewhere in Pakistan. Not quite as worried about it. But, Somalia never had that much going for them in the first place. And then, in the perfect example of the Ladin Doctrine, America just picked them up and smashed them against the wall. Totally destroyed that place. They overthrew a government that was, it was like Taliban light. Very light. Certainly no threat, certainly not Al-Qaeda. Islamic Courts Union and Al-Shabaab, the youth, they were the smallest faction in this union. It was 13 groups in the union. And Al-Shabaab, they were the young guys who had the least amount of influence and authority in the group until the American CIA came in and paid the warlords, the bad guys from the Black Hawk Down days, to come in and, actually solidify their power by trying to overthrow them. And then eventually they backed the DOD and the CIA, George Bush, backed and really, it's in the WikiLeaks, demanded an Ethiopian invasion of Somalia in Christmas 2006, in the beginning of 07. And it was during that war that Al-Shabaab became the most influential group, rather than the least, because again, they're the youth, which means they're the ones who have the rifles and are willing to die trying. And so that was where Al-Shabaab came from. And there's a terrible war, and the Ethiopians just raped and pillaged and destroyed their way across Somalia, as was to be expected. And the Americans have been supporting the Kenyans, the Ugandans, the Burundians, and the Ethiopians in a second invasion after Al-Shabaab originally defeated them and drove them out. After the rest of the Americans put the rest of the African Union forces in there, the Ethiopians came back. And like I said, including the Kenyans, which has led to two major attacks in Kenya by Al-Shabaab now. But the most important part of it is that there was a gigantic famine, especially in 2011 and 12, and it hit the entire Horn of Africa there, in East Africa, and yet, of course, it hit Somalia the hardest, and by far, because the war had completely disrupted whatever markets and distribution systems they actually had going there. And so crops didn't get planted, and the few that did get planted couldn't get traded. The markets were all broken, and people starved to death by the hundreds of thousands because of America's war there, when they could have just as easy made a deal with the Islamic Courts Union. We won't bomb you as long as you promise not to harbor these Al-Qaeda guys. And you know what? Even the official story, according to the Washington Post, was, there were three Al-Qaeda suspects wanted for questioning from back in the days when terrorism was still a crime, and the FBI had a grand jury open on the Africa embassy bombers. Well, we got three suspects wanted for questioning in Somalia. So that was the justification for the regime change. You go look it up. It's in the Washington Post from back in December 2006. And then so after destroying that place, I'm not saying anybody over here, any innocent people deserve it or any kind of thing like that. I'm just saying we should not be surprised that this is happening, even if it does take FBI agents to entrap these idiots. And even then, it was only tricking them into going to fight on America's side, Al-Qaeda's side in Syria. So, what's the big deal, right?
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, so Friday, I was a guest on a guy's show. Mike Essen was his name. And I went to check out the archive, and my audio is absolutely terrible on there. I'm not sure if it was my fault or his. Maybe I was giving him too quiet of a signal. But anyway, you could barely hear what I was saying. I was going to tweet it out, but can't even really hear it. So that's too bad. But anyway, it was interesting because it was all of the Likudnik talking points that you're used to, but with none of the venom. He was a very polite guy, very nice guy. We had a nice conversation about Iran's nuclear program. And, you know, nothing personal against him, just to, you know, kind of characterize as typical. I think it is typical that, and, you know, I ain't bragging. I'm lucky that I know Gordon Prather, and I got taught all about this subject by somebody who knows how to make an H-bomb for real. And so, you know, and then, of course, I got access to Gareth Porter, who I interview all the time on the show. Nobody has a cheat sheet like I have a cheat sheet when it comes to journalism about Iran and their nuclear program and what it all means and that kind of thing. But it's clear that on the right, from the rank and file level all the way to the very top, as I think it was Politico put it, or was it Politico or the Daily Caller put it, the GOP is not going to rely on science for their opposition to this. Oh, no. They're going 100% slogan. It's a weak deal. It's a bad deal. It's not good enough. You can't do it. It ain't enough. And sanctions and terrorism and Israel. And you got that memorized? Now repeat. And, but the thing of it is if, say, for example, Lindsey Graham, he doesn't have a better deal. I mean, the hypothetical better deal that they're talking about is basically just a smokescreen for war. As Justin Logan put it, writing for the Cato Institute the other day, and I think this was our spotlight on antiwar.com over the weekend, and Logan, he's a very, like, calmly stated sort of a dude. He's done, you know, he's not a radical bomb thrower type. Writing for the National Interest, he was saying, basically, there's no deal that wouldn't be good enough for the people who want a deal, that could be bad enough to dissuade the people who want a deal, which is pretty much true, right? I mean, they were already under the safeguards agreement, so what the hell do I care? I mean, the deal's already been made by the Iranians and, you know, the world community that've all signed on to the non-proliferation treaty decades ago. So what the hell other deal is there to make, as far as I'm concerned? So he's right about that. And then, but he's also right that there's no deal good enough that the war party will settle for it. They want a conflict. They know, and everybody knows, that there's no amount of sanctions that they could put on Iran, and certainly not with the cooperation of the European Union and the rest of the United Nations Security Council, which includes Russia and China and the whole non-aligned movement, to get them to go along with a blockade of Iran severe enough that they would give up all enrichment and just have no nuclear program at all ever again. That's what supposedly, you know, we're going for. That would be a good deal. Make them bow down in a way that, it's like we're living in a comic book or something where this is the Iranian regime that we're talking about. The same ones who were so crazy you couldn't possibly negotiate with them in the first place are the same ones that you have to make just absolutely capitulate and have no face left to save whatsoever. Bow down and kiss the ass of the great Satan in front of all of your people and get absolutely nothing for it. It's the offer they can't accept. Like the Rambouillet Agreement. Remember that in 1999? We have the Rambouillet Agreement, and it says that the Serbs must lay down all their arms and allow the occupation of the entire country, not just put in peacekeepers into Kosovo, but allow the occupation of all of Serbia and all of Belgrade, including right up to the presidential palace and the master bathroom there. So, sign on the dotted line. Meaning, they made an offer so obscenely ridiculous that they knew it would have to be rejected and then they would have a pretext for war. It's called politics, Clinton style. And anyway, isn't it amazing how the opposition to this deal, how they don't have to have a coherent argument, really? Well, better deal. More sanctions. More credible threat. If there was a real credible threat behind it, then we'd be more successful at getting what we want. And yet, they're not even complaining. Hey, turning a rock into a light water reactor that can't possibly make weapons fuel as its waste product, that's just not good enough. Well, what the hell kind of argument is that? Sounds pretty good. Well, going from 20,000 centrifuges, including later generation ones, back to only 5,000 and only first-generation ones at that, and guaranteed to continue to limit to 3.6% enrichment, which is in no way a threat of using for weapons fuel whatsoever. Nope, not good enough. Can't have that. Closing down Fordo and turning it into a research facility and no longer enriching uranium up to 20% as they had been doing there. Nope, not good enough. They can't make those arguments, so instead they just oppose the deal anyway. What argument do they need to bother making? Now, the good news on this, I think, is, believe it or not, at Breitbart, the way they put it is that the Republicans caved in to Obama on the Iran deal. That they could have done things to really stop this deal, and they didn't. The first thing they could have done, it says, and I think this is right, they could have passed a veto-proof bill declaring that this agreement constituted a treaty that would require a supermajority advice and consent in the Senate. And that would have killed it. Or they could have passed new sanctions with a veto-proof majority, or passed a bill with a veto-proof majority requiring that Obama cannot remove the sanctions, basically canceling all his waivers without congressional approval, which would, as he says here, would have cut the legs out from under the negotiations and then from under Obama in the negotiations. And then they also could have insisted on a linkage between the nuclear deal and support for Hamas and Hezbollah. They go on to make a bunch of ridiculous assertions about, you know, Iran's tentacles all over the globe. But anyway, you know, they could have put in something about support for anyone outside their borders or whatever in there. And that would, of course, been a deal killer as well. And then as Ben Shapiro writes here, those were the three major options, three and a half. To stop Obama, Republicans pursued none of them. Instead, the bill merely states that Obama cannot remove sanctions until after submitting the text of the deal to Congress, after it's signed. And then they have 30 days to review the deal after it's already kicking in. And they've been out on the summer recess. So in other words, according to the War Party here, they've been outflanked.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And, yeah. You know what? Back to the Middle East in a minute. But first, I want to talk about Ukraine here. Oh, man, you know what? I never did get a chance to read this one. Well, Robert Perry's got a new one at consortiumnews.com. How Ukraine commemorates the Holocaust. Oh, God. I'm afraid to ask. Now, of course, they celebrate it. Many of them. All hail Bandera and that kind of thing. And so it's Adolf Hitler's birthday. And today is the official beginning of training, I think. Really? Did they really do it? They really time it for the 20th to be the beginning of the training? Of the American military training? The National Guard, which is made up of a bunch of Nazis. The right sector, I'm laughing only because it's so absurd. I'm not saying it's not tragic, but I'm not kidding. Back in the day, the Americans even aligned with the communists against the Nazis. But nope, now we're back in the Nazis. The Svoboda Party and the right sector. I don't know if Svoboda has their own militia, but there's the right sector and the Azov Battalion and who knows what others. And they walk around with their 88s and their lightning bolts and their wolf's hook symbols. And they kill civilians. And, you know, the right sector and the Azov Battalion, they basically, I know the right sector has been really become the National Guard, right? And these are the guys that our guys are training, the descendants of the Galatian SS from who served Hitler in World War II, killing Poles and Jews and Russians. Anyway, yeah. So there you go. That's how the American Empire celebrates Adolf Hitler's birthday, by official training for a bunch of Nazis. We'll turn your militia into an army. Come over here, Nazis. And, yeah. So, you know, here's my question. Tell me what you guys think. If America gives a bunch of equipment and a bunch of training to the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian National Guard, again, made up of a bunch of Nazis, then do you think that maybe that increases the chances that the Ukrainian government will break the ceasefire and attack the so-called pro-Russian separatists in the East, even though they're not separatists? And they've been denied permission to join Russia when they asked. So, the deal was ceasefire and autonomy. As Moon of Alabama was writing the other day, they've been attacking, right sector has been attacking and breaking the ceasefire, according to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, who apparently typically do a pretty good job on this. They now have the Minsk II ceasefire that was arranged by the Germans, the French, and the Russians, putting pressure on either side there. And now, I don't know, man. Isn't it funny how no drama Obama is actually the most radical lunatic president maybe that we've ever had?
You know, here's something that's instructive, maybe, especially if you're not too up on this kind of thing. Remember Pat Buchanan, the right-wing extremist Republican, former host of Crossfire, former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, and before that, Richard Nixon. Ardent Cold Warrior, to this day, proud of the entire Cold War effort to contain and even roll back communism. World communism is a threat to mankind. And which, of course, it was, but I'm not saying America needed to be an empire to do anything about it. But Pat does. But this is what he says about our current relationship with Russia. He says, under Ike Eisenhower and Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon, the line was drawn at the Elbe River, which you may know is about two-thirds of the way across Germany, in the eastern half of Germany. East Germany was smaller than West Germany. By quite a bit. And anyway, that was the line, the Elbe River. And all the presidents from Truman all the way through Ronald Reagan told the Russians, if you move your tanks through here, you cross this river and start moving into Western Europe, we will go to war with you up to and including H-bombs. That was the deal. And that was where the line was. And I'm not saying I necessarily support that. I'm saying that was Pat Buchanan's thing. Back then, and still today, he says, that was a sound policy. But now he's saying, look at what we've done. We've moved the line all the way to Russia's border. They brought Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia into NATO. So that, say, what if somebody shoots Putin in the head, and he's replaced not in a color-coded revolution, but in a brown-shirted one. And these guys decide, the next people in power in Russia decide they want to test NATO and go ahead and take the Baltics back, one or all three of them. We're going to go to a nuclear war over Russia moving into Lithuania when Ronald Reagan wasn't willing to do it unless they moved into Western Germany. You know, they sold NATO expansion like it was just kind of one big dinner party for elitists from all different countries in Eastern Europe to all come and get together. It's sort of just the natural sort of kind of component of expanding the European Union. The Americans got to make sure to have their influence across the Atlantic and the EU, so we expand NATO too. But it's a military alliance. They're saying they're willing to get into a nuclear war over all these countries, over Albania, over Latvia. And now how many of you can even find Latvia? And what if the Russians took Latvia? You want to die in a nuclear war with the Russians over that? Does it make any sense at all that this is America's policy? It doesn't. It only makes sense if you're a Lockheed arms salesman. That's what it makes sense for. That's why it was Lockheed that created the Committee on NATO Expansion back in the 1990s. This is how to get rid of F-16s. That's all. And, yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And now we're talking about, and they are talking about bringing Ukraine and still they're talking about even bringing Georgia into NATO, as though Putin didn't make his point back in 2008 when Georgia started the war to try to take South Ossetia. And the Russians said absolutely not and occupied it instead and kicked the Georgians' asses out. As though they weren't making themselves clear when they said, Putin said in 2008 when George Bush held it was the American Empire held the thing, the NATO conference, where they said, yeah, we're putting Ukraine on the track to join NATO. And Putin said, really? Because I could occupy Kiev in 2 weeks. I don't think anything was lost in the translation, really. That was a dare. You know. And anyway, I don't know. It's amazing that the Americans... Here's the most amazing part of it. You know what it is. It's that the Americans can engineer this entire crisis and lie about it and get away with it. And our media is more subservient than Pravda ever was. in tracing this crisis to the occupation of Crimea by Russia, not the coup d'etat that preceded it.
Hey, all, Skull Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, man, how's it going? Oops. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, Wednesday, Nick Turse is going to be on to talk about the invasion of Africa. It's kind of a big invasion of Africa, man. Well, they're training every army. Maybe they'll create one big, gigantic continental war of all against all. What do you think? There could be some profit in that for some selected factions, you know? That's Wednesday. And then I think probably later this afternoon I'm going to record one with Adam Morrow. I don't usually do that, but special occasion. I'll ask him about Egypt and Yemen and things going on. America's sock puppet fascist dictatorship in Egypt. So probably I'll have that on the phone for you tomorrow. I mean on the show. Yeah. And then, I want to talk to McAdams, and I want to talk to Larrison, and I want to talk to Mark Perry about this thing that he did in Yemen. Which is, I guess, what I'll talk about now. I wouldn't mind interviewing him even after I already talked about it on the show, because it's kind of a big deal here. U.S. General Saudi intervention in Yemen, a bad idea. Analysis. Some top officers question Washington's support for Riyadh-led intervention, which they say is doomed. And, anyway, I'm not going to sit here and read it, but the point is that, according to, John McCain, the Saudis did not notify the Americans before they attacked Yemen, and because they're accusing the Americans, they believe we're on the side of Iran now, and so here we are, you know, John McCain, Republican politics. Saying, oh, we're letting down our allies who don't even have faith in us anymore. And this kind of thing. And then a senior commander at Central Command, though, speaking on condition of anonymity, scoffed at that argument. Quote, the reason the Saudis didn't inform us of their plans, he said, is because they knew we would have told them exactly what we think, that it was a bad idea. That's putting it very nicely, not to do it, right? And, you know, this is, this is Mark Perry, the journalist Mark Perry, who's a pretty connected guy. I think he used to be the something or other editor at Foreign Policy. And now here he is writing for America.AlJazeera.com. And, he's a pretty connected guy. He's the guy that wrote about Mossad posing as CIA agents in order to recruit basically Iranian al-Qaeda, Jandala, in order to murder Iranian officers in order to ruin Barack Obama's negotiations with Iran back in 2009, among other times. He wrote that for Foreign Policy back a couple of years ago. But anyway, so the point is that it's not true that the Houthis are just, basically Yemeni Hezbollah or something, Iran's sock puppets. They're just not. In fact, there's a great piece in Bloomberg Saudi claims on Iran's role in Yemen face skepticism in the West, and that is by the real experts who actually know the story of the Houthi rebellion. And they're trying to make this a Sunni-Shia civil war sectarian split where it's really not. Man, I don't remember who it was I was reading now, but they talked all about how the Zaydis in Yemen, they've always prayed side by side with the Sunnis. They just have a slightly different ritual. They're fivers, not twelvers, whatever the hell that means. It's which imam they believe something, something. But anyway, they're not Iranians, and they have quite a different take on Shiism than the Iranian Ayatollahs have. And also, there's just no proof that the Iranians have been sending them a bunch of money and a bunch of guns or anything like that. The headline blares, oh, Iran is sending a battleship. Yeah, just like every other country sent battleships to go and do rescue missions to get civilians out. Many different nations have gone. Everybody's rescuing civilians out of there except America. But anyway, so the point is that, hell, even if the Houthis were being backed by Iran, who are they fighting? They're fighting Al-Qaeda. Here he is quoting a, a Yemen expert who is, he's not a military guy, but he is, quote, close to a number of officers at Special Operations Command and a consultant. His name is Michael Horton, no relation to me. As far as I know, there are a lot of Hortons around. Anyway, this guy, Michael Horton, is saying, first of all, he's saying they don't need Iranian weapons. They have plenty on their own, and they don't need training by the Iranians. They have plenty of training on their own, and they've been fighting Al-Qaeda since at least 2012, and they've been winning. Why are we fighting a movement that's fighting Al-Qaeda? And now remember, Al-Qaeda was almost nothing. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was almost nothing before the Americans started bombing the crap out of it and turned it into a real movement by killing innocent people. Amazing how that works, huh? And so this guy, Michael Horton, the Yemen expert, tells Mark Perry, these constant reports that the Houthis are working for the Iranians are nonsense. But the view is right out of the neocon playbook. The Israelis have been touting this line that we lost Yemen to Iran. That's absurd. The Houthis don't need Iranian weapons. They have plenty of their own. And anyway, you can see why I would want to interview Mark Perry about this thing. But anyway, yeah, this whole thing, that's how crazy it is that America and all our allies are taking the side of Saudi, which is taking the side of Al-Qaeda in Yemen and in Syria. And the Israelis and the Turks and the Qataris are all for it, too. I guess the Qataris and the Saudis tend to back different factions in the same places at the same time, doing mostly the same stuff. I don't know about the Qatari role in Yemen. But anyway, you can see the immediate backdraft from this. That's my thing. Instead of blowback, which is the unforeseen consequences of covert action, the backdraft is when the things you do blow up right in your face immediately. America and Saudi Arabia take the side of Al-Qaeda against the Houthis and start bombing the Houthis. You could call it de facto taking their side, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe that's the whole point of this thing, is to save Al-Qaeda from the Houthis. It's the most obvious result of what's happened, because here the headline reads, Al-Qaeda taking advantage of Yemen turmoil, U.S. defense chiefs say. And, yeah, that's kind of an understatement. When they took an airport and a seaport and an oil terminal and a gigantic munitions magazine, a store warehouse full of weapons. An airport and a seaport an oil terminal, and a giant weapon storage facility. Those are the immediate gains of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula with America and Saudi flying as their air force. And I know they say that, oh, we're leading from behind on this, but it's all American intelligence leading the thing. It's our ships at sea. And the Wall Street Journal had a big piece about this the other day. It's our ships and our AWACS that are, of course, coordinating the entire war. And how do you like that? Just like in Libya, in 2011, you have America's generals and spies saying, why are we fighting on behalf of our enemies? I mean, imagine that. You know, you go back to, I just saw on Twitter the other day, someone was saying, you can say some bad things about Jefferson, but he was right about standing armies being dangerous. Well, how do you like the irony when it's our standing army is trying to rein in the unwise and unworthy passions of our civilian pinstripe suit wearing geeks? And the generals are saying, why are we fighting on behalf of our enemies? And the politicians are saying, because we're being paid.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So I got a couple pieces by Mitchell Prothero here at McClatchy Newspapers. First of all, this one is about the bombing a couple of days ago in Erbil. First attack on U.S. in Iraq since the Islamic State took Mosul. And in Kurdistan, Erbil. A suicide bomber struck the U.S. consulate building in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil on Friday afternoon. Was it that long ago already? I guess so. I thought it was Saturday. Kurdish authorities said that at least three people were killed. A Kurdish security official at the scene said the dead were the three attackers and five wounded. Among the wounded were two Westerners who were in a restaurant across the street, witnesses said. Brett McGurk, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iraq and Iran, said in a post on Twitter that all consulate personnel had been accounted for and there were no reports of injuries among them. Vehicle-borne IED, says here. The Islamic State, which is also pressing offensives in the cities of Ramadi and Baiji, claimed responsibility for the explosion in an internet post. The attack was the first direct assault on U.S. facilities in Iraq since the Islamic State took control of much of the northern and central areas of the country last summer, and only the second bombing in Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan regional government. A city considered so safe that the U.S. moved many of its diplomats here from Baghdad when the Islamic State captured the city of Mosul and threatened Baghdad last year. So there's that. And then, The rest of it was just, you know, details of the actual event itself. So here's the second story is from yesterday. Oil refinery at Baiji secured, but Iraq fighting still rages at Ramadi. So I guess they kicked the Islamic State back out of the oil facility town. I guess my understanding is it's sort of a ghost town, little town that's built there basically to service the refinery. Maybe not. I don't know. It's an old culture. You know, maybe the town was already there. But anyway, small town that this refinery is named after. And, of course, the refinery itself is kind of a small town. But anyway, they've been fighting back and forth over this thing for a long time. It seems like a pretty important test of the Baghdad government's strength and its military that they can hold on to this damn refinery for more than a little while at a time before losing it again. And meanwhile, there was a big announcement. I always like these big announcements about what they're about to do. "We're about to catch Osama bin Laden," blared the headlines in 2006 and whatever, right? "We're about to start withdrawing hundreds of thousands of troops from Iraq," they would say in 2005. "We're about to invade the Anbar province and kick the Islamic State right out of there." Yeah, let me know when y'all get that done. But it is true that with the American Air Force, if they have special forces on the ground with laser pointers or, I don't know, Shiite militiamen with good laser designators, and they're working with the Americans and pinpointing Islamic State targets, I guess, you know, they can get away with some kind of battlefield success if it comes to battles and fields. But mostly it's a lot more of a urban warfare, close quarters, very hard to win with air power type of a war. And how they think they're going to take Fallujah when they can't hold on to Baiji, at least for very long at a time so far. And they had, it took them, a whole month or so to take to Crete. And the population had already entirely fled from there basically by then. And that was with the Iranian Quds Force backing them. And then finally with American air power toward the end there. I don't know. Last time I talked to Prothero, he was about as skeptical as me that the Shiite militias are going to, you know, be full of guys who are willing to go fight and die to liberate Sunnis in Fallujah from the Islamic State. Why would they do that? They don't care enough about the people of Fallujah to do that. And that would basically, that's what it would have to be. And kind of same thing with the Peshmerga. You know, I asked Patrick Coburn on the show that, hey, you know, in 2003, when America invaded, they got the Peshmerga to go ahead and sack Mosul for us and drive the Iraqi army out of there. And the Iraqi army withdrew because they went to go and defend Baghdad. So they went ahead and pulled out of Mosul, which is up in the northwest. And so I asked Patrick Coburn, hey, man, in a hypothetical type situation, what if the Badr Brigade and the Shiite militias are a bit too scary? What about sending in the Kurds into Mosul, assuming you could get them to do it, to want to do it? Send them into Mosul to kick the Islamic State out of there, but then with a promise that they'll withdraw soon, just, you know, they don't want to stay and occupy the place and take it over for Kurdistan or anything. But they just want to drive the Islamic State out, since they kind of have a record of that. They tried to stay, and just after a few days, they started getting shot at, and they left back in 03. And Coburn said, you know what, in Mosul, they're just as suspicious of the Kurds as they are of the Shiite militias. And they're not going to welcome any kind of foreign force coming in there. Basically, anyone that you could take to be the enemy of the Islamic State in Mosul, the people of Mosul are more likely to rally around the Islamic State as their defender from whatever outside force you got. As bad as the Islamic State is, at least they're not the Badr Brigade or the Peshmerga in their eyes. So, makes it a very hard target. But then again, these kinds of things don't necessarily get taken into account all the time. In these wars. So I don't know. I got to admit, though, I guess I was wrong. I Barack Obama, thank God for his squeamishness, if that's what the right wingers want to call it. I predicted that, man, you overthrow Gaddafi, you're going to have chaos. As soon as the suicide trucks start going off, then the Americans are going to have to invade. and build up an army and they'll stand up and we'll stand down and all this kind of crap, right? Otherwise, what are they going to do? They're just going to let Libya be Mad Max beyond Thunderdome from now on? Apparently the answer was yeah. Thank God I was wrong about that. And here, when basically Bin Laden reincarnate, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi gets up there on the balcony like Mussolini and says, I am now the caliph of the Islamo-fascist caliphate that used to be a figment of George W. Bush and Osama bin Laden's imagination. I thought that, well, crap, they're going to have to send in the Marines. If the Peshmerga can't do it and the Shiite militias can't do it, who's going to drive these guys out of Mosul, out of Ramadi, out of Fallujah? Which, I'm amazed that Ramadi has lasted this long. About half of it has lasted this long, I guess, and they're worried about the rest of it falling now. But anyway, who has the strength to do it with ground troops other than the Americans? The Turks do, but they're not going to do it. The Turks are on the side of the Mujahideen. They sure don't mind them and seem to keep supporting them. And so, not that I'm recommending it. Just, I figure with my little thought experiment that there's just no way politically that they can let the Islamic State just sit there. But apparently I was wrong about that. Obama's just going to let it sit there. Hell, it's better than doing something about it. And by the way, I don't know what to make of this. What do you make of this? Islamic State blamed for Afghan suicide bombing that killed 35. The Islamic State in Afghanistan, huh? Taking on the authority of Mullah Omar, the so-called caliph there. Taking on Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And then, I don't know if this one is also photoshopped like the last one. Video shows ISIS killing Ethiopian Christians in Libya. It's that easy to call your local militia part of their militia if you want, I guess. Good PR for them anyway. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. All right, well, I'll keep talking about the F-35 just because I think it's hilarious. You know, I was talking with a friend of mine, and he was saying to me that he was talking to a friend of his. Oh, I know we're in the realm of hearsay now, but it's all right because it's not so much testimony. But he was describing his friend as fairly wealthy, whatever, successful in life, professional type, Republican, well-versed in the ways of things, in the investment world and stuff like that. And he had never heard of such a concept, never had heard the term military-industrial complex. And when he heard it, he went, I don't know, Right, and had some kind of knee-jerk reaction against it. Maybe it sounds like something a communist would say, even if you don't even know what it means. You hadn't even thought about it for a moment to know what it means. But all it means is the weapons lobby, that's all. There's a weapons lobby. Just like there's an agriculture lobby. Why is there an agriculture lobby? Well, because the national government exercises a great amount of authority over agriculture in this society. So anybody wants to grow anything, they got to deal with the government. How do they deal with the government? They hire lobbyists, one, to protect them, and then, secondly, if they can afford it, to screw their competition. That's how it works. That's how it works with anything. And you know what? Skip the fighter jets and the combat boots and just go straight to the hydrogen bombs. Honeywell and the other corporations that make the hydrogen bombs, they have lobbyists. And those lobbyists lobby Congress for more money for more nuclear weapons. Now, these are not, God, you know, perish the thought, but they're not egghead academics who've decided, for whatever brilliant reasons that you can trust, that this is how many nuclear weapons we need for the most nationally secure, national security foreign policy we can have. No. It's the guys that run the H-bomb factories and cash the dividend checks. And if you ask them, they'll tell you, man, we need more H-bombs. In fact, we need more H-bomb factories so we can make more H-bombs. And all the H-bombs we got, we should take them all apart and put them back together again. And we should make more H-bombs. And what is the limit on the number of H-bombs we should make? Never heard of it. Let's make more H-bombs. Senator, a brief moment of your time. And it's the same thing you would do if you were an H-bomb lobbyist. That would be your job. And here's the thing about it. It sounds like, oh, yeah, oh, crazy conspiracy commie point of view or some kind of thing. But it's not even any of that. It's not even scandalous. It's not even a scandal. It's not even a problem. It's not even a conflict of interest. It's just how business is done in Washington, D.C. That's all it is. It's just politics. That's all it is. Politics. How can I sell more H-bombs to this government? That's what the military-industrial complex is. They pay the congressman a tiny portion of money, and then the congressman reaches in the treasury and hands out a much larger portion of money to the people who did the lobbying. And then all the regulators in charge retire early, and they go and sit on the board of one of the corporations they've just been lobbying for a while, which pays them very handsomely, as they knew was the deal when they were working their way up in the regulatory agency in the first place. It's called, politely, it's called the revolving door. Sometimes the iron triangle of regulators, congressional staff, lobbyists, and corporate board members and vice presidents and whatever. And again, it's not even a scandal. You know, a couple of times, way back a long time ago now, read a Tom Clancy book or two. A couple of times I read one or two. Mm-hmm. And anyway, they talk in there about, oh, you know who's really smart? This guy Jenkins over at TRW. Yeah, right now he's doing algorithms for, I don't know what, insurance policies or whatever, I don't know. But he's the guy who's so good at math that you should pay him whatever it costs to get him out of the private market and working for government to help design our missile defense system or whatever. Because he's just the most qualified guy for the job. And this is what the establishment itself, what its members think of how this works. Yes, of course, the most qualified and talented people get passed around between the biggest industries and the most powerful government positions. And let's look at how brilliant they are. They don't even know it's a scandal. So now you look at the F-35. How is it possible that the F-35 is still even a thing at all, when everyone knows it's a piece of junk? Left, right, and center, every expert, every partisan and nonpartisan think tank or group or thing, university program, anybody that produces studies about things of any nature have all produced an F-35 study saying, what in the world are we doing with this piece of junk? It's not fast. It's not stealthy. It can't climb. It can't turn. It can't fly in the rain. It can't fly near lightning. Sometimes the engine explodes on the tarmac. You can't shoot it with a single bullet. The thing will explode and fall right out of the sky because it's got gas tanks all throughout the damn thing. And it can only hold two bombs because of its failed attempt to be stealthy. And then all the sophisticated electronicals that supposedly make it worth it all suck. The helmet doesn't work. All of the, assuming their long range radars and all these things work, it can't communicate with the bases back home, including the brand new USS America, giant, hulking, worthless piece of crap that was designed just for the F-35 and cannot host the F-35. Cannot talk to the F-35. And its deck cannot even withstand the tail blast of the vertical takeoff of the F-35. And you can't fly it in the rain. And it's a complete piece of crap. And all you got to do is type in this. Look at this with your favorite brand of search engine. Type in F-15 designer. F-15 designer F-35. And he talks about how the F-15 was a piece of crap, too. It's quite a bit better now because they've had so much time to overhaul the damn thing since the 70s. But the F-15 was a piece of crap. The F-16 was almost like a secret inside Lockheed that a few engineers who just wanted to make a good plane went ahead and, as like a rogue project, made a good plane. But the purpose of these programs is to simply transfer money to Lockheed. That's what he says. That's what the F-35 is for. It is a success. Its aim is to take money from you, and it works at that. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So supposedly there's a new book coming out about Hillary Clinton and who all donated to the Clinton Foundation and who all paid Bill Clinton exorbitant amounts of money to give speeches while she was the Secretary of State. And then the direct correlations, almost undeniable maybe, correlations to American foreign policies, including on a Columbia trade deal. And what was the other one I'm trying to remember that the New York Times highlighted? The New York Times apparently had read the book, and for what it's worth, they thought it was pretty credible. A meticulous kind of account. And the thing is about it is, are you kidding? You know what I want to know? I want to know about Israelis paying her and paying Bill Clinton and Saudis paying her and Bill Clinton as they're supporting the revolution, so-called, in Libya and in Syria, both of which were Saudi policies. And how about how much were the Saudis paying her for her, for the State Department for America's support for the military coup d'etat against Mohamed Morsi, the democratically elected, though Muslim Brotherhood leader of president of Egypt. Now, I know that happened after she was gone, but she was working with them. It happened about 6 months after she left. But despite the Republican hype that you hear that Hillary and Obama overthrew Mubarak, it was the people of Egypt who overthrew Mubarak, and they tried to hold on to him as long as they could. But his officers, his junior officers, refused orders to massacre the people in the Tahrir Square and said that they would actually fight those who ordered them to do so first. And that was the end of that. But they're not going to want to make those correlations. They might, Columbia trade deal. What's the other one I read about where they were, it doesn't matter. I haven't read the book yet, But apparently it's going to be a political football because the author of it, the publisher, gave it to Rand Paul first, gave it to some newspapers first to build up some hype about it before it comes out. The Democrats are already denouncing it, denouncing the author, and saying it's all a pile of lies. But I have no reason to doubt that. You know, Eric Garris says that he thinks that Hillary Clinton's reputation for ruthless and corruption will only serve her. You know, just like out of a George Carlin bit or something. Yeah, she's completely full of it. And how do you like that? And yeah, it's great. At least she's the most ruthless person in North America that we'll have as our leader. She'll take good care of us with that corruption and ruthlessness. I don't know how the hell they figured that, but apparently, you know, I think he's got a point there, that at least she seems like, to people she seems, I'm not saying I agree, but she has that air of confidence that comes with competence. She's a competent warmonger. Like my bumper sticker, girls can commit genocide just as good as boys can, and that's really what's at issue here, and that's her argument, and I think it's probably a pretty credible argument. I don't know. I also have another Hillary Clinton sticker that has Mom from Futurama. You know, the old lady, the mean old lady who runs the robot factory? I think, you know, that kind of ruthless matriarchal character. I think Hillary Clinton fits in good with that. And I think, you know, Eric is probably right that that appeals to people. That, like, wouldn't you bet on Mom from the robot shop on Futurama to be... at least to last her 8 years, you know what I mean? Kicking somebody's ass in the meantime, if that's what you're seeking in a leader, she's got those leadership qualities. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, you know, I think they'll pay attention to, you know, smaller issues about who was paying, who has been paying the Clintons while she's at the State Department. But I want to know mostly about Saudis and mostly what they had to say about Libya, Egypt, and Syria. And I'm not saying that she had to be bribed or blackmailed or anything to do it. You know, it was the American-Saudi counter-revolution. Uh-oh. How do we co-opt and or judo and or pull the rug out from under and or destroy the Arab Spring? That was America and Saudi's mission, and so they took advantage of it. They did their worst. Anyway, which leads me to the Rand Paul thing. Rand Paul recently has decided that his best thing to do is to attack when he's accused. And what else is he going to do? It's to tell the truth. He doesn't have a good line. I can't think of a good line for him to lie and pander. They're the Lindsey Graham and the right wing hawks. I don't know if they're right wing, but the Republican hawks are calling Rand Paul a sissy, basically. He's not, he's like Obama and Hillary Clinton, weak on foreign policy. And his only answer to that, what else is he supposed to say? His only answer to that is actually, they are hawks, and they're like you. You're just like them, only worse, Lindsey Graham. How do you like that? And he actually said that at this thing in New Hampshire. He said, where the hell is the quote? Yeah, 10 times over. They would have done the same thing that Hillary and Obama did, just 10 times over. Well, of course, he's absolutely right about that. What else are you going to tell us that the truth about that? Obama and Hillary are terrible hawks. They expanded the war in Afghanistan. He doesn't say that. They expanded the war in Afghanistan. They spread it to Pakistan. They escalated it in Yemen and in Somalia. And then they started wars outright on the side of the Mujahideen in Libya and in Syria. Lindsey Graham agreed with them on every single one of those policies, and every single one of them has been a disaster. Now, Rand so far only has limited his answer to Libya and Syria. But you see how Lindsey Graham, what's he going to say to that? You know, if Rand Paul would stick to telling the truth instead of pandering, he's going to turn right around, of course, and go, oh, but I'm the toughest when it comes to Russia. I'm the toughest when it comes to Iran. Oh, yeah, I always was tough on Iran. Don't you ever say that I ever said I didn't need to be tough on Iran and blah, blah, blah. Well, you can see how if their line is that he's weak in the face of these threats, The only real argument to that is, no, you are overreacting in the face of all these not really threats. You're the one who wants to take the side of the Mujahideen in Yemen, too. In 3 out of 4 of these wars, you're on the side of Ayman al-Zawahiri, dude. Enough of this. That's all Rand Paul has to do to win this argument is just to argue about it. And then what does he do? In the same damn thing in New Hampshire, where he slams the GOP hawks, he turns right around and goes, oh, backpedal, backpedal. But you know how we got into this mess. It wasn't because of people listening to Lindsey Graham in the 1990s, listening to John McCain and his preferred foreign policy in the 1990s. No, sir. It wasn't Hillary Clinton's husband, the president, in the 1990s. Oh, no, huh? No, it's radical Islam. Yeah, radical Islam. That's Rand Paul's new explanation. He used to tell the truth. It was George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton that got us into this mess. George W. Bush, who doubled down. Obama, who then tripled or quadrupled down, or whatever you call doubling down on a double down. I guess that would be, what, 8? I don't know, man. No good at math. It's certainly not out loud on the radio. In fact, I got that wrong. It would be just before, right? Yeah. Anyway. Quadruple down. That's all Rand Paul has to do is say, look, George H.W. Bush, well-intentioned as he was trying to restore the King of Kuwait to his rightful throne in Operation Yellow Ribbon, he accidentally picked a fight with our friends, Ronald Reagan's Mujahideen from Afghanistan, where they fought the Soviets. Then Bill Clinton really pissed him off by staying in Saudi and backing the Israelis. Then when they attacked us here in America, George Bush took advantage to make everything 10 times worse. And then Obama outright took their side in Libya and Syria. And so I win and the Hawks lose. And he would win and they would lose. But instead he panders still. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. So it's my show, Scott Horton's show. Yeah, now listen, the other day, and you guys hadn't heard the archives, if you didn't hear it live, well, you hear it later, but if you heard it live, then, you know, interviewed Roger Charles about the Oklahoma City bombing, and one thing that we did not get to talk about at all, just because it's a whole other separate interview, it's just, you know, what are you going to do? But it's a huge part of the story, and I hope that you'll be interested to learn about it. There's a guy, and I talked about it last week anyway. But I wish it had come up with Roger Charles. But anyway, the thing is, it's the story of a guy named Jesse Trenadu. And Jesse Trenadu is a lawyer from Utah. And the reason that he's important is because government agents murdered his brother Kenneth in a federal holding cell at a transfer facility in Oklahoma in the summer of 1995. And they beat him to death, which apparently was not an easy task. And apparently they did so in a case of mistaken identity. They thought that he was Richard Lee Guthrie, who was one of the John Does who 95% helped McVeigh with the Oklahoma City bombing. I guess that's... I forget now whether I really put 100% on that, but it is pretty damn certain that at least they believed that Guthrie was... one of the very close John Does with McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing. And J.D. Cash figured this out, and McVeigh actually even sent Trenadu a letter saying, I know why your brother was killed. It's because they mistook him for Richard Guthrie. Well, guess what? Richard Guthrie ended up dying in his prison cell, too, not much later, the real Richard Guthrie. It was just a case of mistaken identity. And as Jesse will tell you the story, it's the damnedest thing. The same red pickup truck, the same red mullet, the same upper body build and dragon tattoo on the right arm or the left arm, I forget. And the handlebar mustache or whatever. And even a record for bank robbery, although I guess they just figured it was a alias, that Kenneth Trinity was an alias for the same guy who, you know, been busted for the same crime under another name, this kind of thing. And yet, actually, Kenneth didn't do anything. He was, I guess, on the run from a parole violation, but just over, he wasn't supposed to be drinking, this kind of thing, and had gone to Mexico and then came back from Mexico. And the feds, they just conflated Kenneth Trinity with Richard Guthrie, and then they killed him. But then, so the problem for them was that Jesse was a lawyer and one who, you know, took very seriously the life and death of his brother. And so he got the body. He proved that he was, that it was not a suicide. He sued the government for wrongful death. They settled out of court for millions. And he spent all of that fighting them on basically peeling the onion, untangling the knot of Richard Guthrie, Timothy McVeigh, and the rest of the conspirators in the Oklahoma City bombing, who, to make it a long story short, were all a bunch of FBI informants and or flipped state's witnesses for their own legal troubles anyway. The Midwestern Aryan Republican Army bank robbery ring and the Nazis at Elohim City in eastern Oklahoma, and or and possibly including, and I think very likely including, an agent provocateur who was actually sent there to help make this kind of horrible thing happen by the name of André Karl Strassmeier, who was a German army intelligence officer who was working for, I don't know, Roger Charles said he's about to publish something new about this, but I guess the assumption is he was working for the CIA or the DEA or the FBI, or at least under the auspices, you know, maybe cashing a paycheck from the DEA doesn't necessarily... you know, rule in who all he was exactly taking orders from. But anyway, and then, you know, I think probably it's sort of like the sting operation. The Occam's razor thing is, it was one of these bogus stings like the FBI does, where they're supposed to be heroes and catch the guy at the last minute. This is the kind of thing that they were beginning to set up in the case of the first World Trade Center bombing that they called off. In the case of Oklahoma City, I don't know that they called off the sting as much as just it didn't work, and they were outwitted by the Nazis, who even apparently went as far as to get a second Ryder truck to fool the FBI, and 186 people were killed. 187 or 89? Sorry, I forget now. And anyway, so there's just the hugest cover-up. I mean, seriously, the number of criminal charges, if there was such a thing as the rule of law in this country, the number of criminal charges for the people in the Justice Department and the FBI who are accessories after the fact in this crime, at least. Maybe in the first place. And, you know, then later. But just the cover-up. And you could put hundreds of people in prison for going along with this lone bomber crap, where McVeigh's closest associate and co-conspirator at the time was said to be two states away in, you know, to the north there, Terry Nichols, and then in Arizona, Michael Fortier, who knew about it but wasn't necessarily in on the plot or anything kind of thing. But that was all you're supposed to know about. And anyway, it just ain't true, and Jesse Trinity is a hero for everybody who wants to know the truth about that. And as Bob McCarty points out at his blog, bobmccarty.com, that very few news outlets, and this includes even me, mea culpa from the Friday show, even made mention of the fact that there is an Oklahoma City bombing trial going on right now. That Jesse Trinity is suing the FBI, and it's gone to trial under the Freedom of Information Act in order to get the surveillance video that he knows exists, that it's a documented fact exists. So anyway, Bob McCarty's picking up the slack for them a bit there. And the thing is about it, there's a judge in Utah named Judge Wadups. Wadups? W-A-D-D-O-U-P-S. And apparently his attitude is he's not too impressed by shiny Justice Department badges. He's got a lifetime appointment. And he kind of seems to get pissed off at them. And of course, the latest part of this scandal, which we've covered on the show recently, is the witness intimidation, or at least witness tampering on the part of the FBI, where they have they don't have a subpoena for the guy, but he was, I guess, very politely invited to come and testify, and he was then advised by the FBI, you don't have to, don't go and testify. And his testimony was going to be about what was called PACCON. That was the name of the FBI investigation, infiltration of the radical right in the early 90s. And this guy knew all about it and had some things to say. And Jesse Trinidad was trying to get him to come to trial. And the FBI agent has been actually forced out, has had to resign from the FBI over the scandal of intimidating this witness, or, you know, encouraging him to go on vacation and miss the damn trial. And so the judge is pissed again, and I guess we'll see what happens. These things take time. But Jesse, you know, I think has been very heroic, because he knows that he's in this position of picking up the slack for the rest of the system of justice in America. Because of the situation that his brother was murdered, he has this exceptional window into this situation. Not a window. He's got a hand. He can reach into the process, the legal process of this, and get work done. He's got tons of documents released so far. And anyway, hope you'll learn about him. You can read about him in Mother Jones. There's a good one by James Ridgway, In Search of John Doe 2. If you want to take a look at that, that's a pretty damn good one. Okay, now, also, I'm sorry my website's down, but when it's up, which should be today, they say it should be today, you can go to scotthorton.org/documentaries. I didn't make any of them, I just recommend them. And if you click to the second or third page, wherever it is there, you'll find three Waco documentaries: Waco, The Rules of Engagement, Waco, A New Revelation, and then the third one, again, is called The Fleer Project, and that's the final proof. And anyway, watch those, man. It's good. You'll be glad that you learned that story, if you didn't already know it, about what happened to the Branch Davidians. It's a big deal, and everybody's doing their anniversary stuff, and I hate for the government to have their fake narrative of both of those events dominate. So I like to try to tell the truth in the place of that kind of crap. And, man, I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about the rest of these articles. Missouri National Guard labeled civilian protesters enemy forces. FBI overstated all their forensic hair matches. Fake science. And experts doubt Oklahoma accidentally grabbed a stun gun.